Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, I bet some of you are asking this question, when will my grown-up kid grow up? That is a lot of boomerang kids. A lot of our children are coming back to visit us, live with us, ask money from us, maybe sometimes ask advice, rescue them. So we have a lot of adult children who are coming back home to live. And if you want some answers to that, stick with us because I've got two great people who are experts at this. First, our guest is Dr. Jeff Arnett, who's the author of a brand new book called When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. And to visit with us, we've also got a local expert on this topic. Helen Johnson is also an author about college-age kids and how parents, who you called, Helen, I guess, helicopter parents, some advice for what parents should do with the kids who are becoming adults. And so on behalf of Helen, Jeff, we welcome you to Chapel Hill and thank you for coming to talk to us about your book and also about some challenges that most of us have along the way.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about your book.
Well, we wrote this book because adulthood takes a lot longer to reach than it used to. And I think sometimes parents are blindsided when their kids get to be in their early 20s, even their mid-20s, sometimes their late 20s, and they haven't really grown up in the sense that most of us understand that term. So they haven't yet entered marriage, haven't yet had a child, maybe haven't finished their education, and still need financial support from their parents. And I think when parents have young kids, they figure they're going to be done by the time the kids get to be 18 or maybe 22. And it turns out they're not. So our book is really about how they're not done and what sort of issues come up mainly in the 20s for parents and their grown kids to deal with and how to deal with them effectively.
Why is it different today than when we were breaking away, in my case, well, many years ago, back in the 50s or the early 60s? What's different?
Well, you know, so much has changed, hasn't it? The 60s and 70s were really a watershed in American society. And that's when things really started to change in so many ways, including this. So women's roles changed. Instead of being mainly wives and mothers, they were still wives and mothers, but went into the workplace in huge numbers as well and into higher education. There was a sexual revolution that really changed sexual morality and made premarital sex and cohabitation normative or typical. Not everybody, of course, but they went from being fringe sort of things to things that were very common. The economy changed from a manufacturing economy to more of an information and technology and services economy. And that meant you couldn't just walk into an automobile factory, as I did actually at the age of 18, and get a job that paid very well. And you could have supported a middle-class family on that wage. Now you can't do that. And you need education. You need training beyond high school and either college degree or some kind of technical training or professional training in order to get a job in a new economy. So those are some of the things. We've changed so much as a society since you were reaching adulthood yourself. And that's changed how kids experience their 20s, especially. I've proposed that it really means we have a new life stage. We used to go from adolescence to young adulthood around the age of 20 when you were growing up in the 50s and in the early 60s. And now, as we say, 30 is the new 20. It takes until about 30 to reach the major adult transitions, financially self-supporting, married, parent, long-term job. And our book and Emerging Adulthood is really about this stage in between. Emerging Adulthood is what happens now that adulthood is so much later. It's instead of being a stable entry to adulthood, it's the most chaotic and unpredictable and changeable decade of your life.
Well, arguably, I guess the parents of the folks in my generation would say, well, it might be difficult, but we don't have any responsibility anymore because they graduated from high school, or in other cases, we got them through college, and we know they're going to have problems, as we really did in the late 50s and 60s. But what keeps our parents from saying that, yeah, it's difficult, we sympathize with you, but you're on your own?
Well, some parents still do say that. But most of them realize that times have changed and that adulthood comes later and is some ways more difficult to achieve because of the road you need to follow in education and in entering the workplace. And parents, you know, they love their kids. They want to see them succeed. They want to see them be happy. So most parents, I find, are willing to help their kids financially and also in terms of giving them connections to jobs and emotional support and so on through their 20s, as long as they feel like the kids are pursuing what we call in the book a plan with a capital P. I think that's the key. Parents want to see their kids trying. They want to see them making an effort to move toward adulthood and self-sufficiency. And as long as they see that, usually parents are going to say, you know, as long as you're striving, I'll try to help you get to where you want to be.
Well, Helen Johnson's with us. And Helen, you're the author of a book about parents of college-age kids.
Parenting college
And you've
students,
now, you've
yes.
read Jeff's great book about when will my grown-up kid grow up. And it includes the 18 to 29-year-olds, so it includes the college age. You give good advice about college-age parents as well.
Well, I think, first of all, Jeff, I want to congratulate you. The book is wonderful, and it's really needed because of what we used to call the floundering period after college. And I commend you for having created a new life stage as well.
Which is?
Emerging adulthood.
Emerging adulthood.
We actually, in 2000, when my book first came out, it was clear to me, I had started the parents program at Cornell University. It was clear to me that parents really needed help on understanding their role, because most people have parenting books through the teen years, but it didn't extend really. What I find interesting, and I'd like to get your comment on this, is I think a lot of this kind of emerging adulthood and the whole creation of this as a new life stage has a lot to do with historical time period and parenting style. And that's my theory. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that, the enmeshed family, the helicopter parent, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is something that I've thought about and written about some too. I think the baby boomer parents who came of age in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of talk then of the generation gap, as you know.
Right.
And they really felt a distance between themselves and their parents, their so-called greatest generation or silent generation parents, maybe because the pace of social change was so great then. But there was a lot of talk of that distance between grown kids and their parents at the time, or kids reaching adulthood and their parents. And I think the baby boomers decided that they didn't want the same distance between themselves and their kids. They wanted to be less authority figures. You always have to be an authority figure to some extent as a parent, but they didn't want there to be as strict a hierarchy between themselves and their kids as there was between them and their parents. And I think they succeeded. And in some ways, that's good. I think parents and kids are probably closer than ever before, especially dads. I mean, the role of dads really changed in the last 50 years. Now you have dads who routinely hug their kids and tell them they love them and, you know, help with the diaper changes and help make the meals. They're really more like equal partners in the household, although the women still end up doing usually the majority of the work. But I think parents overall, they succeeded in that closeness with their kids, and the kids benefit from it in a lot of ways. But I think your point, as I take it, you're implying that sometimes it's too close. And I would agree with that. Sometimes it is. But I think generally kids need emotional support from their parents. They need that closeness in their 20s because, unlike in the past, they don't necessarily have that intimate partner the way they did 50 years ago when they married at age 20, 21, 22. Mm-hmm. You had a partner in life from the time you entered adulthood, and that person was your ally, and you faced the world together. Well, now if you don't marry until you're 27, 28, 32, who's your ally? Who are you really going to rely on when you're through most of your 20s? Well, you might have a boyfriend or girlfriend or close friend or somebody else to rely on. For most people, they're still going to need their parents. They're still going to need to come to them for support now and then, even as they're also striving for independence. And I find that over and over again, mostly they don't want to depend on their parents, especially financially in their 20s, any more than they need to. They sometimes need to, but they generally prefer to stand on their own as soon as possible because money is power. And as long as their parents are giving them money, their parents still have power over their decisions, and they want to make those decisions for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Jeff Arnett. We're also visiting with we're accompanied by Helen Johnson, who is our local expert on boomerang parents. And the three of us will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Helen Johnson is my co-host. She is the author of a great book about parenting children who are in college. It's called Don't Tell Me What to Do, Just Send Money, The Essential Parenting Guide to the College Years. And we have the privilege of visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Arnett, who's the co-author of a new book called When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. And these are for parents not only of college-age kids, but all the way from 18 to 29. And so I'd love for both of you to help me. If we had a minute or two, and I've said, what are the biggest mistakes that parents make in dealing with their children in this age group? What are some of the mistakes that we make?
I would say the main mistake that parents make is not knowing how to step back and not being able to give their kids enough freedom to make their own decisions in the course of their 20s. We talk a lot in the book, me and my co-author, Elizabeth Fischel, we talk a lot about the balance between stepping back and staying connected. And I think the staying connected is the easier part for most parents because they love their kids, they care about them, they want to stay involved in their lives, even as they also are moving to a new stage of their own lives once their kids move away. But the stepping back is hard because, you know, as parents, we're used to controlling things. We're used to making decisions for our kids. We've been doing it since they were born. In fact, even prenatally, we were making decisions about what we ate and what they got as a consequence in the case of the moms. But all through their lives, we're making a lot of decisions for them about where they're going to go to school, what they're going to do on their vacations, how they're going to spend their summers, things like that. And they get to be 18 and start going through their 20s, and they want to make more of their decisions. So they want to decide what they're going to major in college. They want to decide whether they're going to come home on their college summers. After they get out of college, they want to decide where they're going to live. They want to decide who they're going to live with. And it might be a romantic partner, and the parents might not look too favorably on that. That happens quite frequently. And it's a challenge to parents because kids need to learn to grow up. They need to make their own decisions. They need to make more and more of these important decisions in the course of their 20s so they can set up the structure of an adult life. But it's hard for parents to step back when they see their kids making decisions that are not the decisions that they would have made and that may, in fact, be unwise. I mean, your kid decides to major in a theater instead of engineering, even though she has talents at both. Parents have to bite their tongue a lot of times because they're thinking, God, you know, engineering, there's a self-sufficient career for you right off the get-go.
Is continuing to be directive rather than backing away and taking another role.
It's not being able to step back and let your kids make their own decisions about the big issues of life, mainly education, work, and romantic partner.
Well, Helen, jives with what your book says, I think, about
it. I think so. I would agree with that. What I've noticed in going out and talking to parents at colleges all across the country, you know, orientation, now it's time to step back kind of talk, is that I noticed a fundamental difference in parenting when for children who were born about 1980 on. That would be the millennials. And all of a sudden, there was kind of a perfect storm of societal connections that happened. One, people started marrying later. People had fewer children. There was the first research that showed that you could affect brain development even in utero, hence the Mozart tummy packs. And there was a revived interest in children, but fewer children, therefore much more energy and time. And we may say this is a middle, upper middle class phenomenon as well, as many of those former professional moms in their maybe mid-30s stopped work as a lawyer or in the corporate world and became completely focused on the children. And this is good and bad, in my opinion, but I think parenting became professionalized in a way and competitive in that era. And these children were the products of parental need to have themselves reflected well in their children. Mm. And that's the dark side, in a way, that you're way too identified yourself with your child's success or failure. Whereas my parents, I went and did my life. That was up to me.
Well, one of the things I think both of you point out in your books, Jeff, particularly remembering chapter that you've got just on the new technology that we've got that has an impact on the our ability to communicate with each other all along that we didn't have, again, when I was growing up when I was in the emerging adult category. What impact has technology had both on the positive side and the negative side of the relationship between parents and adults between 18 and 29?
Well, that's a huge impact, isn't it, on all of us, but including on the parent-child relationship, I think, at all ages and maybe especially in this period of 18 to 29, whether they're moving toward adulthood but not there yet. In my research, part of the research I did for this book was the Clark University Poll of Emerging Adults. It's a national survey of 18 to 29-year-olds. And we found that slightly over half of the 18 to 29-year-olds said that they are in touch with their parents every day or almost every day. And to people of older generations, they find that astonishing and rather troubling because they're thinking of how when they went away that first semester, that first year of college, they didn't hardly talk to their parents at all, maybe every 2 weeks for 5 minutes, maybe not mm-hmm. until Thanksgiving. And there's a natural tendency, I think, for all of us to think that our way was the best way and that anything that's different than that is worse than that. But I tend not to think so. I think actually the technology is a great thing. And during this time of life when kids often do feel lonely and adrift after they've left home but don't feel confident quite standing on their feet, it's really nice to be able to know that there's somebody there who really cares about you that you can have daily or almost daily contact with. And the kids, they will control it. If their parents are too intrusive, if their parents are texting them too much, leaving them too many phone messages, they can just not answer. And sometimes they do. They're very much in control of the technological contact with their parents. And so I think it's mostly a good thing, not always a good thing. Obviously, any technology can be taken to an extreme. But I tend to see it as a thing that helps emerging adults get through what is otherwise a difficult and stressful and often challenging and anxiety-producing time of life.
What about the psychological theory that says if these children have been brought up and never allowed to experience the bumps in the road because their parents are the snowplow parents shoveling ahead of them to make sure everything's fine, and if they've grown up with getting a trophy for participating as opposed to winning, and they're completely embedded in this I am special feeling and that I am worthy of extra care and attention at all times. What about the psychological construct of learning to deal with difficulty on your own and that being a standard part of becoming an adult. My feeling is that this constant technological umbilical cord truncates that process. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because this is something I've written about and thought about a lot. And it is a topic of some controversy within the field of developmental psychology. Have parents indulged their kids too much? Is there too much emphasis on self-esteem? Certainly there's more emphasis on building your kids' self-esteem, being positive and affirming about them now than it was 50 years ago. I don't think anybody would dispute that. Mm-hmm. But what is the outcome of that, I think, is the real question. Have we created a generation of spoiled kids who think they deserve a trophy for everything and are even, as some people have said, narcissistic, which is a real strong word to use about right. anybody.
Right.
And I've looked real closely at that research and at my own research, too, and I don't believe it. I think it's not true that this is a selfish generation. In fact, really the opposite is true. If you look at just about any objective measure of changes in behavior over the mm-hmm. last 20 to 30 years. So all the things we identify as problems have gone down. Everything from substance use to mm-hmm. criminal behavior, even automobile fatalities, substance-influenced automobile fatalities, sexual risk behavior, all the things we regard as major social problems that are especially common among 18 to 29-year-olds, those have gone down remarkably in the course of the last 20 years. And meanwhile, things like volunteering have gone up. In this Clark poll I mentioned earlier that we did, it was a national survey of 18 to 29-year-olds. One of the items we had on there was, it's important to me to have a job that does some good in the world. 74% of those 18 to 29-year-olds agreed with that. And I don't think they're just saying that. I find it to be a very idealistic generation, a very globally aware generation that are really concerned about contributing to making the world better. And I think that means we're doing something right. I understand the concern about overpraising them and inflating their self-esteem too much. And I'm sure that happens in some cases. But I think overall, as a generation, it's hard to find evidence that that's actually true, at least in their behavior.
Well, Helen Johnson and I are visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Arnett, the co-author of the new book, When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. The three of us will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with Dr. Jeff Arnett, who's the co-author of a new book, When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. This is for parents of children who are 18 to 29, part of this emerging adult generation. And during the break, Helen, you raised a question I asked you to talk uh-huh. about on the air.
Well, I'm a mentor to a 10-year-old African-American little girl here in town. And she and her family have upset all my theories of parenting and child rearing. They are lacking in resources, single mom, four children, a tough life. And yet this child is the most confident, self-evolved child I've ever met. And her brothers are the same, and they're 14 and 13. And
how old is the little girl?
She's 10. Mm-hmm. I began asking myself the question, and one of the reasons I feel that she is so empathetic toward others and so aware and keen on other people, to the degree that she's comfortable with adults, talks to them, looks them in the eye, says hello, is that she does not feel like she's the center of the universe. She feels like she's an integral part of her family. She's expected to turn to and get things done for her family. And in my view, just having observed this for a year, that gives her tremendous confidence. It also makes her a little bit irked when she has to do extra things. But in the end result, it gives her a sense of purpose that she's really contributing to this family and her brothers as well. Whereas I look at her in contrast, and I hope my children never hear this show, that to my grandchildren, who tend to be entitled, a little bit whiny, and waiting for the next fabulous thing for them to happen for them in their lives. And I think if you have, which you have now, which is the millennials, brought up in general with this, I think we should make a distinction between self-esteem and self-efficacy, because I think the kids are pumped up with self-esteem, but never actually asked to perform and then be evaluated.
Well, let's get Jeff's reaction. That's, I mean, that is a challenging concept, and you clearly there are examples of kids who had two tough lives who don't survive that. But I guess any time that you survive and thrive in a tough experience, you can say that was better for you. But where's the borderline?
Well, I actually agree with Helen to some extent on this. I mean, it's a very old finding in developmental psychology going back 60 or 70 years that what's really best for kids is a combination of warmth and control.
Right.
So love them, make them feel good about themselves, make them feel that you really value them and tell them so. But also set boundaries, require things out of them, require household responsibilities, set limits and enforce those limits. That, I think, is the most durable finding in the branch of psychology that I'm in. And it's pretty common sense, too.
Right.
And so I think we know that if you just praise kids, and no matter what they do, you praise them, and you don't have any consequences when they're disobeying you or breaking the rules or not treating others well, that's not good for them. But what I dispute is that we've done that with a whole generation, that we've just given them praise and we haven't required things out of them. I think if that were true, then we would see the negative effects in their behavior. So we would see more sign of them treating others badly, more things like criminal behavior, sexual irresponsibility, when they get to drive, automobile-related irresponsibility. They wouldn't stick with education. And so they would get less education than they had gotten previously, because education takes a lot of self-discipline. And the thing is, none of those things turn out to be true. So all of the things that we would use to objectively see, do we have a problem here in the way we're raising kids, in the sense that when they reach adulthood, they're not functioning well. Those things just aren't true. And again, volunteering has gone up steadily. And yes, some of that in high school is to get on your college resume, but it's true even in college, and it's true even beyond. So organizations like Teach for America and AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps and a whole range of others that have sprung up to fit the demand are overflowing with kids. Teach for America gets something like 10 times as many applicants as they can take, who are willing to go in a rough part of an urban area for a year or two, give a year or two of their lives to try to teach kids who are disadvantaged. That's an amazing thing, and that's what a lot of kids in this generation are doing.
So, Jeff, are you arguing that kids who are brought up in this arguably overprotective and loving, affirmative environment are better equipped to go be servants than those who've been brought up in tough, real tough circumstances?
No. I'm saying that as a generation, if you compare kids now to kids 20 or 30 years ago, you see all the trends you can see are good ones. Certainly, I'm not disagreeing with Helen. I think absolutely there are families and there are segments of society where kids don't get the control part of the warmth and control equation, where they're not required to be responsible and to think of others and be considerate of each other. I don't dispute that at all. And that probably is mostly the more advantaged sector of society, because your example is a very telling one. And I've interviewed a lot of emerging adults like that, too, who grew up in tough circumstances. And you think they would reach their 20s and be a mess, but they're not, actually. They're generally kids who have learned from that they had to take responsibilities from an early age. And by the time they get to their 20s, they're sometimes doing amazing things. So I don't disagree with you. I just think we have to be careful about characterizing them as a generation, that they're spoiled, that they're overindulged, right, as this idiotic Time magazine cover from a few weeks ago, the me generation. It's really unfair to them because it doesn't fit them as a generation. It's hard to characterize any generation as a generation because obviously we're all diverse at any particular time. You're talking about tens of millions of people. But I think for this generation, I would ask people to hesitate before you ridicule them and before you characterize them in a negative way and apply negative stereotypes to them, because I don't think the evidence fits that.
We're visiting with Dr. Jeff Arnett about his book, When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. And Helen Johnson and I will be right back with him after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Helen Johnson and I are visiting with our visiting guest, Dr. Jeff Arnett, who's the co-author of When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Adult. And if you joined us late, Helen Johnson lives with us here in Chapel Hill, and she is an expert in her own right about, Helen, forgive me, I say boomerang parents, but her book, which has been well received, is Don't Tell Me What to Do, Just Send Money, The Essential Parenting Guide to the College Years. And, of course, Jeff's book is about a wider group of people, but including the college years, the kids from 18 to 29. What I want to get, since we just got a little bit more time, Jeff, you've got some great tips, just some general rules about to give to those of us who are in the situation of having kids this age, general advice. Can you sum it up for us a little bit, some of the ground rules or some of the things that you've learned that are helpful to parents in this generation?
Well, there are a lot of them in the book. One topic, though, that is worth mentioning that we haven't talked about yet is money, because we found that is the number one source of conflict between parents and their 18 to 20-year-old kids. And it's for obvious reasons, I guess. You know, they're moving toward a time of life where at least the beginning of that 18 to 29 age period, most of them are not capable of being financially self-sufficient. Either they're going to school and working part-time and so not making enough to support themselves, or they're working in a job that doesn't pay very well. I mean, of course, you start at the bottom when you're just entering the labor market. And a lot of those entry-level jobs these days, as we were saying earlier, they're not the manufacturing jobs that are going to pay you $30 or $40 an hour. They're service jobs or beginning-level business jobs that don't pay very well. And so parents are often asked to help their kids out for maybe longer than they expected. And parents, first of all, often aren't expecting that because, as I said earlier, they're often feeling like by the time their kids are 22 or 23 at the latest, the kids ought to be out there working and supporting themselves. And that often turns out not to be true, either because the job they have doesn't pay enough, or because they can't find a job, or because they want to take an internship that they think is going to lead to something and that doesn't pay anything at all.
So what should parents do?
So we talk a lot about this, about how you need to have an honest money talk with your kids. It helps to start even before they leave home. Think about the next 5 or 10 years and talk about what you're going to be able to afford and what you're not going to be able to afford, what the limits of it are, so that everybody has the same framework of assumptions going into it. And then have that talk again and again during the course of the emerging adult years, where you talk about how much the parents are contributing and whether they're comfortable with that or not, and what the kids are doing with that financial support. Again, having a plan with a capital P is really key to most parents. If they see their kids are trying to make their way towards self-sufficiency, they might not be crazy about helping to financially support them in their 20s, but they're usually willing to do that if they can. But if the kids are not, if the kids are floundering, if the kids don't seem to be trying, if they just seem to be coasting along, then parents understandably are upset about it. And then parents need to have tough love and say, look, I can give you this much money for this long, and then that's it. You're going to have to support yourself.
Jeff, you
and
don't have any,
that necessary.
You know, what would be, I'm always of the mind from the earlier generation, just tell me what to do. You know, give me a rule so that I can cite it. And I think, as you explained in the book, you're not willing to give an ironclad rule that says, okay, in most cases, pay for the undergraduate education and then let the – even if you can afford to pay for graduate education, put the responsibility on the kid to make those decisions.
Yeah, the hard news of our book, in a way, is there aren't any magic formulas for being a parent of 18 to 29-year-olds. You know, it's not like when they were infants and you could tell parents burp after feeding. You know, I'd like to be able to tell you that, and there'd be a magic solution to these money issues and everything else, mm-hmm. but there's not. It's different for every kid, and parents have to make their own judgments about it. But we try to give parents information and examples for how other parents have addressed various problems so that they can make their own decisions.
I interrupt you, but the ironclad rule that I found that you were willing to say is talk.
Yeah.
That is
– That helps you avoid misunderstandings at least.
That many of the things that I worry about in terms of having these rules, we can get to a solution – if I'm really willing to listen
right.
and talk to my kid.
And the other thing is have a plan with a capital P. So talk to your kid at 17 or 18 when they're about to leave home and say, well, how do you want your life to look in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and how are you going to get there? And the answer may well be, I have no idea at 18. But by the time they're 22 or 23, they'll have a better idea. And hopefully by the time they're 26 or 27, they really will know. But by encouraging them to think about a plan with a capital P and the extent to which parents are going to be involved in that and the extent to which kids want to make their own decisions on that, you can avoid conflict or at least minimize it.
Well, I loved the parts of your book that were ironclad rules. And I remember, Helen, maybe – I don't know whether you remember this or not, but I thought it was so good – is that you do not ask your 18 to 29-year-old, maybe married child, when am I going to have grandchildren?
Yeah, or why haven't you given me a grandchild? Yeah, that's even better.
But you've got some other
– Now, you have to avoid that. Again, the hard part is biting your tongue. The hard part of that staying connected and stepping back equation is the stepping back part, because you feel like you know better, and you probably do. You have more life experience, and you really know your kids well. You can see things coming a long way that are going to be problems that result from their decisions. And so you would rather make those decisions for them. But unless it is some serious thing, like they're involved in an abusive relationship or their work involves something illegal, you need to let them make their own choices, even if those are not the choices you would have made. Even if those choices might not turn out well, one of the ways you learn in the 20s is to make mistakes. You fall down, you brush yourself off, you get up again, you move on. And you have to be willing to let them do that.
When your beautiful, intelligent daughter, 25-year-old, comes home with a jerk and says she's going to marry him, and he's a lazy, slouchy, no prospects kind of guy, but your daughter's deeply in love with him.
It's not your decision.
You can inquire. Tell me what you love about him, I guess, so you can see him from her perspective. If you see things that really worry you, you can mention them. You're probably going to get rebuffed. If you say, gee, you know, it doesn't seem like he's very ambitious, you're probably going to be told, look, back off. But you have a right, and you might feel a responsibility to do that. But you have to remember, it's their life to live.
And ruin.
Maybe. Yeah. But maybe you don't see the gem in that guy that she does. And, you know, it could be that you're wrong. But in any case, I have found over and over again, from 20 years of interviewing emerging adults and the last several years of interviewing their parents, they're going to make their own decisions. Even if you don't like that guy, she's going to make her own decision about whether to marry him. And your only choice is going to be, do you want to be part of their lives or not? If you are really anti that guy, believe me, he's going to feel it. And your daughter's going to feel it too. And then they're just not going to come around as much. And that's not something most parents are going to want, especially after those grandkids are born.
Right. Well, gosh, guys, I wish we had a lot more time to talk. But Helen, we froze you out on this section. Have you got a quick reaction to what we've been
talking
about?
No, I just think, Jeff, I'd like you to go back to Clark and get busy on another book about married children and that relationship. I know you touch on it a little bit at the end, but that needs much more.
I'm hoping to do that next, actually.
Well, excellent.
So I'll see you next year.
Okay. Well,
maybe 5 years. Might take
right.
longer.
Well, Helen Johnson, thank you for joining us. What a great thing
pleasure.
It is to have a visit with you. And Jeff, thanks for coming back down to North Carolina, this time instead of Duke to the home of the University of North Carolina. Thanks
You're welcome.
For your for the insights in your new book, When My Grown-Up Child, When My Grown-Up Kid, When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? This has been a great conversation.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.